Basel III Endgame will make it harder for consumers to buy a house or a car. It'll hurt the small businesses that rely on loans to grow, and it'll reduce savings for people with money in pension funds. Regulators propose capital requirements would take a toll on families, seniors, farmers, and small businesses. Washington, scrap Basel III Endgame and start over.
Hello, listeners. Welcome to Politico's Nerdcast. I'm Scott Bland, your host. This week on the show, we have a very foreign policy-focused week at the White House to talk about. We learned that the head of the CIA, Mike Pompeo, made a secret trip to North Korea. Japanese Prime Minister Shinzo Abe came to Mar-a-Lago to golf with the president and talk trade. The U.S. ambassador to the UN, Nikki Haley, said there'd be sanctions on Russia. Donald Trump changed his mind. And there was a little bit of back and forth about all that. And we'll talk about a fantastic story from this week about how the diplomatic world and corporate America have adapted to the way the president changes his mind. They've just started to ignore Donald Trump's tweets. What a luxury. Plus, a topic I love, campaign season. We're going to jump into a little bit more evidence this week that the GOP should be worried about how the midterms are shaping up, new fundraising numbers. Look, for pretty much as long as there's been money in politics, people have said money doesn't win elections, and that's true, but we'll dive into why it's important and what it means at this point, 201 days from the midterms. And there's another special election coming up, this one in Arizona. Should be a piece of cake for Republicans, but we'll dig into a little bit and tell you exactly what's going on there. A reminder to our listeners to subscribe to the Nerdcast, rate us, and write a review, and stay tuned for the end of the show for a contribution from one of the Nerdcast's biggest fans. One more note before we begin, we are taping this a little bit before noon Eastern on Thursday, April 19th, so it's all up to date as of then. Okay, let's get started. I want to welcome our guests, White House reporter Andrew Restuccia. Thanks for being here.
Thanks for having me.
And first-time Nerdcaster Megan Casella, who covers trade for Politico. Megan, good to see you.
Thanks. Happy to be here.
All right, so our first data point today is the number one, as in one Senate Democrat must support Mike Pompeo's nomination to be the new Secretary of State in order for him to reach the 50-vote minimum to be confirmed. But that hasn't seemed to have stopped him from taking on some of the duties already. Andrew, we learned this week that Mike Pompeo, who's now the CIA director, the Secretary of State designate, has made a trip to North Korea a couple weeks back to kind of prod along these negotiations over the country's nuclear program.
Right. I mean, you know, on one level, the CIA is doing a lot of the sort of work with North Korea, so it's not a surprise. But you know, people also saw this as sort of a trial run for his role as Secretary of State once he's confirmed. You know, he went over there. This was a total surprise to people in Washington, including a lot of people at the White House that didn't even know that this had happened.
Wow.
Yeah. So I mean, this was certainly seen as a trial run, and the White House is making that point very loudly to anyone who will listen on the cable news shows and elsewhere, basically saying you got to confirm this guy. I mean, he's key to our relations with North Korea now.
And that was one of the arguments that Pompeo's opponents had been mustering, was that he was too hawkish to be America's chief diplomat. And then we see the White House surrogates like Senator Tom Cotton coming out this week. He was quoted in a Politico story saying this is the best evidence imaginable that he is committed to diplomacy.
Right.
So let's go ahead and get him in there.
Yeah, exactly. And, you know, we basically know nothing about how that meeting went with Kim Jong-un and Mike Pompeo. And we don't really know what's to come in terms of President Trump's planned meeting with Kim Jong-un. They're supposedly debating five different sites for where that might occur. But it's very much up in the air. And Trump said yesterday that, you know, if he feels like it's not going well, he's just going to walk away.
A threat that he's made on a number of different occasions about a number of different subjects.
Exactly.
Right? This is one of his big negotiating tactics. All right. So we see red state Democrats still publicly undecided on Pompeo. They need to pick off at least one of them in order to get Pompeo confirmed, because Senator Rand Paul of Kentucky is voting no.
Although Rand Paul has agreed to kind of consider it, right?
Aha. Yeah. Interesting. New development.
Yeah. So Trump talked to Rand Paul yesterday about this, and he said, just sit down and meet with Pompeo. And Rand Paul agreed.
Interesting. Okay, yeah. So we'll have to keep an eye on that. All right. Meanwhile, another major player in the region, Japan, had their prime minister in the United States, Shinzo Abe. He was visiting with President Trump in Mar-a-Lago. Megan, they talked trade. Doesn't sound like they came to much of a deal, though.
It doesn't sound like it, no. And I think both sides sort of tried to sugarcoat it by saying that they're going to work towards some smaller bilateral free fair and reciprocal trade deals, but they offered no details as to what that means. And neither leader really got exactly what he wanted, because Trump wanted Japan to agree to launch a full-fledged bilateral trade negotiation. Abe said no. Abe definitely doesn't want that. It would be bad for him politically back home. And he's still trying to push the Trans-Pacific Partnership. That's how he wants the U.S. to engage. So that didn't happen. And then on the flip side, Abe was trying to get an exception to these steel and aluminum tariffs that Trump handed down last month that, you know, a number of other U.S. trading partners were exempted from, and Japan wasn't, and Trump didn't give that exemption. So neither leader really got what he wanted.
And of course, the Trans-Pacific Partnership was a big thing in the 2016 campaign, right? This big multi-way free trade agreement linking that would have linked the United States and a bunch of countries in Asia. But obviously, the Trump administration pulled out of it. There was that little glimmer, that little hint, a week or two ago about it. It was like, maybe we should jump back into this. And that seems to have faded.
That hope has died down that Trump might consider rejoining the deal. He's now twice publicly walked back those comments he made last week to other lawmakers. But those 11 other nations that are still part of the deal, led by Japan, have moved forward. So that's where Japan's focus is and where they're trying to get the U.S. to engage.
And it's kind of put the U.S. on the outside looking in a little bit, right?
Absolutely. Sure. And it's interesting that we're seeing now, too, as the U.S. is going back and forth with China and trade tensions are escalating there. You know, the TPP was big economically, but also geopolitically. It was a way of bringing together, you know, a dozen Asian Pacific nations on the Pacific Rim and not China as a way of bolstering them against China. So, you know, people are saying, President Trump, why won't you reconsider this as you're trying to take on China by yourself now?
Right. We're going to jump into this a little bit more later, but I know we're jumping around a little bit, but there was so much happening like on the White House and the international front this week. The big drama from this week, Ambassador Nikki Haley, the U.S. ambassador to the United Nations, was the victim of something that seems to happen a lot these days. The president had a plan, but then he changed his mind. Andrew, bring us up to speed there. What happened?
Sure.
I promise we're going to tie this all together in one big, neat bow.
Sure. So last week, you know, amid the discussion about strikes in Syria, the president was basically also presented with a plan to impose new sanctions on Russia in addition to the ones that the U.S. has already imposed. He, from what we're told, and my colleague Eliana Johnson has done great reporting on this issue, he agreed to that plan. That was communicated to Nikki Haley, and Nikki Haley went on a Sunday show and basically announced that on Monday, Treasury Secretary Mnuchin would announce those sanctions. A few hours later, the president got word that she said that and said, I never signed off on anything like that, and they basically had to backpedal. Now, I think like what you're seeing is what happens all the time, right, with this president. He says one thing, his advisors believe that he has agreed to something signed on the dotted line, and then he changes his mind when he has more time to think about it. And this put Nikki Haley in a really difficult position this week because the White House basically blamed her for it, basically said that she was confused was the word that Larry Kudlow, the National Economic Council director, used. And it basically made her look like a fool, and she struck back pretty aggressively.
Very aggressively. I mean, that line, she says, I don't get confused.
Right. Like that, with all due respect, I don't get confused.
That could go down as a classic.
And you just
we'll see
don't
where Nikki Haley's career goes. But this is very different than what we've seen previously from Trump advisors.
Everyone on his staff is expected to basically bow down to the president. And you just haven't seen a senior administration official so publicly challenge the White House and get away with it, right? I mean, we're not hearing that, at least for now, that her job is in jeopardy. You know, the president, by all accounts, does actually like Nikki Haley. There is some concern that she is sort of positioning herself for a run for president eventually, right? Which, as that talk sort of becomes bigger, is certainly going to anger the president. But, you know, she basically said, I'm not going to stand for this.
And it worked.
And it worked.
For now.
For now. Yeah.
All right.
Check in next week.
Yeah, exactly. All right. So, Megan, there are a couple of these threads now that we've talked about that all run through this great story that you did this week that had a very blunt headline, The World Learns to Ignore Trump. Tell us about how people from the business world, foreign powers, have all been sizing up this gap between what the president says and what the president does.
It's exactly what that headline says, which is that they're learning to ignore him. And what we really mean by that is that they're taking everything the president says with a grain of salt. And it's especially when he's speaking off the cuff, when he's tweeting. You know, my colleague Ben White and I, we were talking with market analysts, Wall Street traders, as well as, you know, looking into comments that diplomats made last week when Trump was floating the idea of rejoining the TPP. And what they were all saying is that, you know, we're listening, we see this, but we're not reacting right away. So we're talking to people who are saying they're looking at the forest, not the trees, or they're looking at the climate, not the daily weather. You know, whatever metaphor you want to choose, the lesson that they've learned is to follow the trend and not the tweets. And so, you know, what that looks like is that, you know, one analyst told me they often are not at all reacting to something the president says off the cuff or that he tweets, unless and until it's repeated by another official or put out through more official means, like put out through a White House statement. And until that happens, it's just sort of, you know, another comment the president makes that everybody brushes off.
That's interesting. It's not just a blanket ignore policy. It's that they've come up with this like system of steps, right, to walk through. It's like, okay, the president tweeted again. Let's take out the checklist.
Exactly. I think they realize they can't just bury their heads in the sand. They can't totally ignore what the president says, because in a way, you know, these are presidential statements. And I think more tellingly, they at least sort of give a hint of what's on the president's mind at any given time, which, you know, alone doesn't mean anything and alone doesn't signal a great policy shift, but does at least give a hint of, you know, maybe what he's thinking about.
What are the dangers because there are dangers inherent in this, right? I mean, there's got to be that worry that we're going to miss the time that he really does mean right. It, and we're going to end up behind the eight ball on something very important, be it, you know, potentially a trade or anything else.
I think that is the worry. I mean, especially with some of these things we've seen with China on trade, some of them on China's side did happen pretty suddenly. So if you're not listening at all, you know, there's the danger that someone's fired by tweet or, you know, something's done by tweet that you're not paying attention to in the slightest. So I think people at least are still, you know, at least looking at these various tweet storms, but not necessarily reacting to them right away.
And meanwhile, you know, when it comes to trade and the Trans-Pacific Partnership that we were just talking about, that how Trump kind of opened himself back up to it and then kind of swung the door closed, but it's not really clear where exactly it stands right now. I mean, that's a big deal for a lot of American farmers who are watching this very closely and maybe hanging a little bit more onto those words and tweets than some of the people making the business decisions were who have been watching this happen again and again all what is it now? A year and a half almost.
Right. Absolutely. That was the other part of the story that didn't make it in to the story that Ben and I wrote yesterday. And it's that I was talking with some folks. I talked with Wendy Cutler, who was the Obama administration's one of the chief TPP negotiators. So this is an example of someone who has a huge stake in seeing the U.S. rejoin this pact. And her point was much more optimistic. And she was saying, yes, this wasn't a well-thought-out comment. It was likely just trying to placate the farm state lawmakers who were in the room and who want to see the TPP reconsidered. But she was saying that this at least shows every time he does this sort of thing, it's the second time in 2018 he's floated the idea of rejoining. Every time he does this, it at least shows that it's on his mind. And that maybe later on down the road, he might be in another meeting with another group of people who talk about another benefit of TPP. And, you know, she's hopeful that maybe little by little, if he continues to do this and continues to be thinking about the TPP and talking with others about the TPP, he might eventually say, okay, this is for real. Then maybe we really should reconsider it.
And I also wonder, I mean, you know, I think we all hesitate to put sort of strategy on top of what the president says off the cuff. But I wonder, like, how much of this is the president sort of liking the chaos and liking the confusion and liking people not knowing what he's going to do at any given time. And this could apply to any number of issues, but I think particularly on trade, I mean, he likes the idea that if people have a glimmer of hope, maybe they'd be more likely to sit down and come up with some sort of new deal, even if that is not in the cards at the moment.
I think that's probably true. I mean, you were talking about farmers, and they're one that they're hungrier than ever for new markets and export opportunities. And they're also a big part of Trump's base. So I think that that's an example of a constituency that if they think the president at least is still considering trying to keep them happy, they'll be more willing to work with him and sit down and try to talk to him about how to get there.
And at this point, though, it's unclear if they're feeling that way. There seems to be a lot of pain in the Midwest, especially we've talked about soybeans a few other times on the podcast. But there was this great story in the New York Times this morning out of North Dakota that quoted right up at the top of the story, a Trump-voting North Dakota farmer saying, you know, if he doesn't understand what he's doing to the nation by what he's doing, he's going to be a one-term president, plain and simple. And he's the guy went on to say that, you know, this is going to hurt the Republican running against Senator Heidi Heitkamp, who's one of the most vulnerable Democrats up for re-election in 2018. And the story went on to just make this really interesting point that this burgeoning trade conflict or whatever you want to call it with China is putting two of Trump's key constituencies. You've got kind of the old school like manufacturing interests in the Midwest versus farming interests and is putting them a little bit at odds because in an effort to boost the manufacturing folks, he has opened up the farmers to retaliation from China.
Absolutely. So it's interesting to see, you know, we've seen Republicans in these red states, these farm states, come out really harshly against what the president has done on trade recently because they recognize that. And they're saying, you know, these are the people that you should be listening to. These farmers need markets. They need export opportunities. And come time for retaliation, they're the ones that are going to get hurt first.
I'm really curious to see what happens on this. I mean, it's the politics and the policy are so intertwined, mm-hmm. especially as we get closer to November. It's who knows? I mean, who knows what's
right.
going to happen? But
yeah.
I'm interested to see what it is. All right, let's leave it there. Megan, thank you so much.
Thanks for having me.
And Andrew, great seeing you.
Thanks.
On to our next data point, which is 43. 43 Republican incumbents were outraised in the first quarter by Democratic challengers in the House of Representatives. That comes from a Politico analysis of the latest Federal Election Commission fundraising reports filed in this past week and covering the first 3 months of the year. And my colleague, Elena Schneider, has been digging through them. Elena covers campaigns for Politico. Great to see you. Thanks for being back on the show.
Thanks for having me.
Okay, so we should set the stage by laying out a couple things. First of all, incumbency usually comes with a fundraising advantage. And secondly, Republicans were hoping that the big tax bill that they passed at the end of 2017 was going to give them a fundraising boost to start this year, that they were going to be able to go to donors and say, look what we accomplished, shower us with your money. It seems like neither of those things have turned out to be the case.
So let's tackle these one by one. So the first one of incumbents raising more money, it's definitely true. They're supposed to have a network that they've built over the years or term that they've been in office where they can go to people and say, look, I'm your member of Congress. Donate to me. There's a certain amount of name recognition that comes from being on the news all the time. So generally speaking, they're supposed to have an edge in fundraising rather than someone who's a first-time candidate starting from scratch. But the problem is not so much that Republicans didn't raise money at all. They did raise money. But the issue is that they just didn't raise enough to go up against this tsunami of Democratic energy that is fueling and powering these candidates. So it's not that the Republicans are not raising anything. It's not enough. And it's not as much as what Democrats are putting behind their candidates. So that's point one. And point two, for tax reform, what's been interesting is there's a couple of different explanations that I've heard from sources. One of them is that, oh, actually, really, that hasn't filtered down yet to candidate level fundraising, that it's more focused on the committees and CLF, Congressional Leadership Fund, an outside group, that it's more sort of, it's collecting at the higher levels, it hasn't trickled down.
We're running out of time here for it to trickle down.
We are running out of time. But another explanation that I also heard, which maybe is a little more candid and a little bit more honest, is that tax reform isn't going to make a huge difference for donors to individual candidates. It's more about the atmospherics of what it might do for how voters feel. And it's an easy excuse that they used at the end of Q4 to say, oh, this is actually the reason why we weren't able to raise as much money, because in the last quarter, more than 40, I think about 43, 44 were also outraised. And so a lot of, strategists were trying to pull back and say, oh, really, it's just tax reform's fault. And the source I talked to was saying, well, we used it as an excuse then. We're running out of excuses. We don't have anything left to blame other than the fact that these incumbents aren't working hard enough.
And let's bring in some context here. Like this is unusual. There's always incumbents who get outraised in both parties, but the scale is unusual here. Another data point that you pulled out in your story this morning, there are 16 Republicans who already have less cash in their bank accounts than a Democratic challenger. At this time in 2016, there were only two who fit that. And so you can kind of see how this becomes a problem, right?
The
builds up district over district. The scale is getting big.
The scale is a huge problem for them, that it's not just happening in a couple of one-off places where they really can cover you because they've got these enormous outside groups who can help sort of shore up those people who are a little bit weaker, the weakest in the herd. There's a huge part of the herd that is really struggling right now. And on top of that, another data point that we talked about in the story was that in these competitive Republican-held open seats, so these are places like Ed Royce, Daryl Issa in Southern California, places where people have chosen to retire.
Two retirements.
They're scattered all across the country. We counted about a couple more than a dozen of these open, competitive Republican-held seats. And in almost all of them, in all of them except two, we counted, Democrats lead in cash on hand in those races as well. So it's not just simply incumbents that are facing cash on hand shortage. It's also those places where they need to hold on to hold on to the majority, where they're going to have to be forced to spend even more money to make sure those candidates try and get over the edge. So it's basically at every level and in every place in the House map right now, they're having money problems on the candidate side.
If it was just the money, I think the Republicans that you talked to would have been a little more optimistic about this. But the point that some of them made is it's not just that their candidates trail in cash. It's what that represents. It's that this is representative of broader trends.
That fundraising is a metric to measure energy. And at the end of the day, you can raise as much money as you want to. You can talk to as many people as you want to, but it may not be enough if people just don't want to vote for you. And that is part of what they're seeing as this is another piece of evidence that shows that the energy is against them, that they're swimming upstream in this cycle. So it's part of a larger picture that already looks pretty bad for them.
And that larger picture looks a lot like a mirror image to 2010. We dug out the dusty old donor rolls from the GOP wave in 2010 yesterday, and we're looking at this. At this point in 2010, 35 Democratic incumbents had been outraised by Republicans, so very similar numbers. But with the benefit of hindsight, now we get to go see over one-third of them went on to lose in the fall. And then another third of those, you know, this was like a name of the dear, a roles of the dearly departed, like former Democrats in Congress. It was people
Democratic
who kind of filtered out. Maybe they lost or retired 2 years or 4 years down the road, but most of these people were not in Congress anymore. And so that was just a very interesting and stark thing to pull out.
Well, it's a warning sign. It's just, again, I mean, if every red light and alarm bell and if people weren't hearing it, they are very deaf because it's very obvious what's building here. But it's just whether or not it's enough. And, you know, and Republicans will point out, though, that even with this this energy deficit, they're still managing to hold on in things like the generic ballot, which we saw tighten a little bit, which they attribute to things like tax reform, actually, you know, and a positive economic environment that we're in right now as evidence of like, okay, maybe things aren't quite as bad as everyone is claiming they are, but they may be holding on to something a little.
Right. We should still say they're holding on because, you know, the generic ballot is more like Dems plus 4, 5, 6 right now than like 10, 11, 12,
exactly.
Right? They're still behind.
Right.
Right. So
they're trying to find good news in a pile of really not good news.
It definitely is good news for them that those poll numbers have gotten a little less bad, but they're like still on the cusp of like really bad territory.
Right. And Trump is up slightly, but like going up from 38 to 40 isn't enough to really to shore up a majority.
Right. President Obama was at like 43, 44
right.
in 2010 and 2014. And those ended up being horrific years.
Right.
For
they
his
lost
party
63 seats yeah.
in 2010. Now, let's go. We started to go district by district a little bit. But another one of the interesting things that you found out as you were going through these FEC reports is that if you look at, you know, some of the districts that we all knew 1 year, 2 years, even 4 years ago, that in 2018 they would be battlegrounds, if you look at them, those Republican members are raising tons of money. Talking about like
Barbara Comstock.
Right next door to us, Barbara Comstock, right, in Virginia.
Yeah. Carlos Curbelo, Peter Roskam in the Illinois suburbs, in the Chicago suburbs. Yeah, I mean, those battle-tested incumbents who've come in recently and who have known for a long time that their race was going to be a top target, they're acting like they are a top target and that they're running 10 points behind, which they have to do. And I kept hearing this about, you know, in comparing to 2010 or comparing to 2006, Mike Duhaime, who was running the RNC's political arm, you know, political director back in 2006, pointed out that it wasn't the top tier incumbents who lost in 2006. It was those second and third tier members who were in R+5, R+7 districts.
They thought they were a little safer.
They
maybe.
Thought they were fine. They had been running races like this their entire careers. Things were okay, and they got hit by it, and they didn't do enough to prepare, or they realized it was too late. And once again, we're seeing that play out in fundraising, where we're seeing these members who, not the ones who are in these traditional battleground seats who are always running tough races, but these ones like Being from North Carolina, I'll point out two North Carolina members.
I knew you were going to go to North Carolina. I knew it.
Robert Pittenger, right outside of Charlotte, is doing better. He's picked up a little bit in the last quarter, but is certainly not raising enough to match Dan McCready, this Democrat who's running against him, who's raising just huge sums of money. And Ted Budd, who is just outside of my hometown in Winston-Salem in Yadkin County, where he is running against this woman, Kathy Manning, who, again, is putting in huge sums of money into that race. So Ted Budd is new. He was just elected. So he, has a little bit more work to do as an incumbent to try and figure that out. But Robert Pittenger has been there for quite some time and yet is still getting out race. So both of them are sort of districts that are on the edge that in a wave could go.
Let's talk about a specific race right now. We've got a special election coming up next week in Arizona.
We do.
It has
the never-ending special election season.
Special election season encompasses all seasons. This one hasn't gotten the same amount of attention, at least during the election. It got a lot of attention when it happened. And Trent Franks, you may remember, resigned amid a scandal. We don't have to get into the whole thing. I'll read one headline from December that'll more or less get you up to speed from Politico. Female aides fretted Franks wanted to have sex to impregnate them. So there you go. He's not a member of Congress anymore. There is a special election on Tuesday to replace him. Tell us a little bit about this district. Where is it? What are its politics like?
Well, so part of the reason why this district hasn't popped up as much, at least in the national focus, is because of the reality of the district. So this is Western Phoenix suburbs, mostly suburban, a little bit of rural, super white, and pretty old. So it plays home to Sun City, which is, I have come to find, is a place where people can drive around their golf carts on the roads.
So I was just about to say the golf cart is the car of choice.
Exactly. Because why not in Arizona when you don't want to get into your big car, just drive around in your golf cart. And, it's a pretty strong Trump hold. He won it by 21 points in 2016. It also plays home to Sheriff Joe Pryo. That's the Maricopa County is his base. That's where he launched his Senate run from. And so I think that this is just a place that isn't really ripe for Democrats flipping over.
There are two demographics that we spent a lot of time talking about with other special elections in the last year.
Right.
There's this kind of like well-educated, white, younger, like professional set that's maybe trending a little bit. And then in Pennsylvania last month, we saw this kind of more ancestral Democratic, like the working class, the union vote that had drifted Republican for a while, but that the right Democrat was able to snatch them back a little bit.
Right.
There is not really that kind of key constituency in this Arizona district for Democrats to latch onto
right.
in the same way.
Right, exactly. And so because of that, there's sort of an awareness amongst Democrats that this is really, really a reach. It's, at a certain point, there are places where a wave cannot touch. And so this could be one of those places. But then again, you never know in a special election. And so let's dive into who's running. So Debbie Lesko is the Republican candidate, and she made it out of a primary that was actually plagued with its own scandal. She was running against a Republican, Steve Montenegro, who got into all kinds of issues with texting staffers and having extramarital affairs. Anyways, not worth getting into. But bottom line, this district has some problems with relationships with women. So he did not win, and Debbie Lesko did in fact win. So everyone, on the Republican side felt a lot better when she was on the ticket now. And she's running against this woman, Harold Tippermany, who is an ER doctor and researcher and advocate and is somebody who has mostly tried to track middle of the road. But unlike Connor Lamb, who the Democrat who won in southwestern Pennsylvania, she had to go through a primary. So there are a couple of places on healthcare where Republicans feel like she was pulled to the left before getting into this general election. Bottom line, this is not a place where Democrats can really amp up turnout. At the end of the day, there aren't a lot of Democrats who live there. This is a pretty red district. But what they're hoping for and what they feel like they've been able to have some success in is getting crossover vote, is getting people who don't like Trump or who are disappointed with the way that the country is going as of right now and want to send a message. And so we've seen some different polling on this, both internal and public, that shows that Tippermany has had some success at getting anywhere from 10 to 14% of Republicans to actually back her over Debbie Lesko. and that independents, which there is a chunk of in this district, may also be swinging her direction. So basically, if everything magically goes right for Tipper Nenni, she not only has a chance of getting this super close, there is a world in which she could win, but at this point, it still seems pretty unlikely.
All right, we'll be watching those returns on Tuesday night. And after that, we've got primaries coming back up. We've got primaries in Ohio and a whole bunch of other states coming up in May.
So May and June, nothing but primaries.
That'll be a lot of fun. Yeah, you can, those of you who are listening now can join us on Tuesday nights for live chats and stories and live results and all that sort of stuff. Every Tuesday, basically, from now until the end of time. Super fun. All right. Thank you very much, Elena, for talking us through those fundraising numbers and the special election. We'll have you back again soon for everything else.
Thank you so much for having me.
The best things in life are free, but you can give them to the birds and bees. I want money.
Okay, as promised, we're going to turn things over briefly to one Nerdcast superfan. Nick Brown of New York City is going to help us out with the credits this week. He's a Nerdcast OG. Those are two words that don't go together at all. Anyway, a Nerdcast OG who's been with us since episode one. Nick, take it away.
Nerdcast is produced by Bridget Mulcahy and Micaela Rodriguez, with help this week from Adrian Hurst. Dave Shaw is the executive producer. Nerdcast's researcher is Zach Montalaro, and their illustrator is Bill Cookman. If you like Nerdcast and you're listening on Apple Podcasts, rate the show and leave a review. It helps new listeners find the show.
Thank you so much, Nick. Listeners, we found Nick because he emailed to say he was a fan. If you're a fan of the Nerdcast who wants to read the credits, let us know. Shoot us an email at nerdcast@politico.com. Thank you so much for listening. We will talk to you again next week.